We are continuing through 2 Samuel this morning, coming to the 20th chapter. David has just come back across the Jordan River and returned to his capital of Jerusalem following the end of his son Absalom's revolt. But I want to start this morning by recapping the end of chapter 19, for the benefit of those of you who were not able to join us last week, which is actually over half the people present today, although I think some of you joined via Zoom. But we need a little bit of context coming from the end of chapter 19, so I want to start in verse 40. Then the king went on to Gilgal, and Kimham went on with him. All the people of Judah and also half the people of Israel brought the king on his way. Then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, "Why have our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household over the Jordan, and all David's men with him?" All the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, "Because the king is our close relative. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift?" And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, "We have 10 shares in the king, and in David also we have more than you. Why then did you despise us? Were we not the first to speak of bringing back our king?" But the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. So, barely has peace been restored to David's kingdom when a new conflict flares up, this time between David's close kinsmen, the tribe of Judah, and the other 10 tribes, who have taken offense because they did not get the honor of being in the king's escort. And we observed last week how, on the surface, the behavior of these people appears to be very fickle. One day, they're fighting with Absalom, trying to kill David and install a new king. The next day, they're fighting with each other over who gets the honor of helping bring David back to his capital city. But as I shared with you last week, I don't see this, if you look a little deeper, as so much being fickle as being very consistent and devoted to the most common cause to which people are devoted, which is the cause of self. When Absalom's revolt seemed to have momentum, when he was the rising star, so to speak, people jumped on his bandwagon. Why? Not so much because they loved Absalom, but because they loved winning. They wanted to be on the winning side. They wanted to have favor with the person that they thought was likely to be the next king. But now that Absalom's dead and the revolt is over, they're competing with one another for who gets to be the closest to King David. Again, not because they love David, but because they love themselves. And they want to get for themselves the best position possible, with the closest proximity to the throne. So we have another conflict. And it's interesting to see the way in which it unfolds. Going on into chapter 20, now there happened to be there a worthless man whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite, and he blew the trumpet and said, "We have no portion in David, and we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse, every man to his tents, O Israel." So all the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah followed their king steadfastly from the Jordan to Jerusalem. So by now, hopefully, it's pretty obvious that the fight between the men of Judah and the other 10 tribes wasn't over who got to honor David the most. It was over who would get the honor of being the closest to the king at this time, and who therefore could expect rewards and favors in return for their loyalty. There are two main kinds of affection in the world, and both of them are called love. But only one of them actually meets the biblical definition of the word love. You could give them many different names, but for purposes of what we're talking about today, I'm going to call them self-seeking love and self-sacrificing love. And self-seeking love is by far the most common type of love that there is in the world. It is completely natural and carnal. Jesus referred to this kind of love in Luke chapter 6, verse 32. He said, "If you love those who love you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them." Go to the darkest places in the world with the wickedest and most hardened people. Go to the prisons, the supermax prisons, and you will find people who love those that love them, who will do something good for you if you've done something good for them. People, I've seen people actually almost brag about this on social media and say, "If you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you." It's as simple as that. And they seem to think of that as a virtue. It's like a flex. It's like, I'm fair. If someone's nice to me, I'll be nice to them back. But Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, or I guess the Sermon on the Plain in Luke, it's like, so what? Like everybody, literally everybody does that. It's part of human nature to love those who love you. Self-seeking love has this main feature. It is dependent on some type of reciprocity, which is, means equality in the relationship. You do something for me, I do something for you. I love someone or something because I get something for myself out of the deal. Now, we should note that this self-seeking aspect of carnal love is not always obvious. Some people who are characterized by self-seeking love appear to be very sacrificial people. A good example of this would be those that enable their loved ones to continue in lifestyles of abuse or addiction, sometimes even abusing the enabler. What are those enablers seeking for themselves? They think of themselves as being sacrificial. And that's what they get out of the deal. Is this concept, the world calls it codependence. It's this idea that I'm a good person because I put up with this person in my life that's addicted or that's abusive or whatever the case might be. And that's what they get out of the deal, is this concept that I'm good because I put up with that, I help them, I'm there for them. And in reality, what they're doing is enabling that person to destroy themselves and those around them. But one of the most common ways that self-seeking love gets exposed is when the lover stops getting whatever it was they wanted for themselves. And quite often, the love at that point doesn't just stop, it actually turns to hate. We saw this in this story a few chapters ago with Amnon, David's son, and his sister Tamar, whom he violated. And before he did that, it said that he loved her, so much so that he became sick over the fact that he could not have her. But as soon as he got what he wanted and found it unsatisfying, he hated her. He wanted to get her away from him. It turned into exactly the opposite, or I should say, it became exposed for what it was. Because the truth is that self-seeking love is, at its heart, self-love. I want something for myself, and it ends up being expressed as though it were care for someone else, but in reality, it's care for me. This is exactly what we are seeing in the rebellion of Sheba with these 10 tribes. You notice a moment ago, the 10 tribes were saying to Judah, "We have 10 portions in the king." And then they're not getting what they want, they're not winning the argument. And so this guy pops up and says, "We have no portion in the king." And they're like, "Okay, that's fine." You see, they go from one extreme to the other. From an extreme of acting like they're so loyal and they want to be close to David and they want to show him honor to, "Well, we don't even care about you. We're just going to take our little red wagon and go home." One of the hallmarks of true agape love, the love that comes from God, self-sacrificial love, which is the other kind of love, much rarer. One of the hallmarks, according to Paul, in 1 Corinthians 13, is that love never fails. Even when love stops getting what it wants, even if love never gets what it wants, it remains because it is rooted in the character of God who does not change. God does not love you and me because he gets something from us. He loves us because he is love. Believers are not the only ones that can experience or give self-sacrificial love because of what is called common grace. God has put this kind of love in the hearts of people who do not know him so that they might be led to find him. You find this kind of self-sacrificial love very commonly in parents for their children, especially mothers. You find it in some people who want to care for the weak, for the downtrodden, or the oppressed. But the purest form of self-sacrificial love is found only in one place, and that is at the cross of Jesus Christ. If you want to find an example of love that gets nothing in return, love that just gives to the max without expecting anything back, you will find it at the cross of Jesus Christ. Romans 5, verses 6 to 8 says this, "For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." I don't know that we can really get the full impact of what Paul is saying here, because we ourselves are the sinners. And so we might be inclined to think Jesus died for people who just were a little messed up, who weren't quite getting it right, who had some flaws, who had made some mistakes. No. Christ died for people who were the enemies of God. Think about sending your child to die on behalf of ISIS terrorists. Then you may have just a little bit of an idea of the love that God has for us, that he gave Christ for us while there was nothing in us that was desirable to him. So God has shown us what this perfect self-sacrificial love looks like. Not only that, he has given access to us. He has given to us access by his Spirit to this self-sacrificial love. Unfortunately, even in the church, we are often content to operate merely in the realm of carnal self-seeking love, love that costs us little or nothing, and we often end up acting quite like the Israelites when they did not get what they wanted from David. When we find that that person is not reciprocating, I am not getting what I want and need out of this relationship, I think I'm going to go find someone else. And this is how many, many, many marriages end. This is how many churches split. This is how many families disintegrate. What is happening is the exposure of the fact that what was there was a self-seeking love, not a self-sacrificing love. So what do we turn to when we turn away from God and his self-sacrificing love that he has poured out on us and wants to pour through us? The Bible calls Sheba a worthless man. Now, I do not believe that this is meant to indicate that he had no worth in the sight of God, because every image bearer of God has worth in that sense. Rather, I think it is meant to indicate that he was not a talented, qualified, accomplished leader. He wasn't even a charismatic usurper like Absalom had been. He was, as we might say today, a lowlife. People followed him, not because he was such a compelling leader, but he was in the right place at the right time to express and vindicate the anger and offense they felt at not getting what they wanted from David. And when we pursue this path of self-seeking love, it often leads us to pursue worthless things. Needless to say, They don't seem worthless to us at the time. They seem right and good and satisfying, but in reality, they are empty. Proverbs 14:12 and 16:25 say, "There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way to death." There are an infinite number of these wrong ways in the world. There are an infinite number of worthless things to pursue. But there is only one way that is right. There is only one person who is worthy, and that is Jesus Christ. One day, all the worthless things that people have spent their lives pursuing are going to be exposed. It's going to be like when the sun comes up on a haunted house and you realize nothing was what it seemed. As soon as the light shines on it, you see it for what it is. Isaiah speaks of this day in chapter 2, verse 20 and 21 of the book of Isaiah. "In that day, mankind will cast away their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, to the moles and to the bats, to enter the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs, from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty when he rises to terrify the earth." That day will expose every worthless thing that we have pursued in our rebellion against God. Much better to recognize it now, to have God shine his light on it and realize, this is a worthless thing. This is not something I want to give my life to. Verse 3, David came back to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 concubines whom he had left to care for the house and put them in a house under guard and provided for them, but did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as if in widowhood. Unfortunately, one of the lessons that keeps cropping up in the latter half of the book of 2 Samuel is that sin has consequences, and those consequences keep reverberating through the years and even through the generations. These 10 concubines were pretty much innocent victims. I mean, I don't know whether they had any choice in becoming David's concubines or not. Probably not. He was the king. He could probably take whoever he wanted, probably make them an offer they could not refuse. God never told David to take concubines at all. God's design was one man and one woman. David got the idea to have concubines from, I guess, the kings around him or from Saul. But he went further than that, as we know, and he took a woman who belonged to another man, Bathsheba. And it was directly in consequence of that choice that Nathan told him, your wives are going to be violated by someone else publicly. And these women paid the price for what David did. Not only having that extreme humiliation inflicted upon them, but now being sentenced to what amounted to a lifetime of imprisonment. I mean, I'm sure they had decent living conditions, but what kind of a life is that? Living as a widow. So many people in the history of the world have borne the consequences of someone else's sin. Many times in silence, many times unknown. How does God compensate them? How is justice done in the end? We don't know. One thing we do know, justice will be done. There is no one who has ever suffered as a victim of someone else's sin that will not, in the end, receive justice from God. There was no one ever more unjustly treated than Jesus Christ, because though he never sinned, all the sin of the world was put on him. And on the cross, he did not complain. He did not protest. Even though he could have, and he would have been right. He would have been right if he'd said, I've done nothing. He did not. This is what he did according to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 23. When he was reviled, he's talking about Jesus, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. If you find yourself in this position, suffering unjustly. Continue entrusting yourself to the one who is just. Because there will never be a wrong that he does not right in the end. The day of judgment is not just a day of punishment. It is also a day of vindication, of righting wrongs, of lifting up the oppressed, throwing down the oppressors. That day is coming. And those who could never plead their own cause in this life will have it pled for them by the only one who actually has the power to do something about it. Verse 4, then the king said to him, Amasa, call the men of Judah together to me within 3 days and be here yourself. So, you may recall, Amasa was actually David's nephew, Joab's cousin. He had been put in charge of David's army. So he had been Absalom's general. He had led the rebel army against the armies of David. But after Joab disobeyed David's orders and killed Absalom, David fired him and he made Absalom his general. Now, this is a huge opportunity for this guy. I mean, think about it. How many defeated generals who have led a rebellion not only don't get executed for treason, but get offered the job of the general who defeated them? I mean, huge opportunity. So what does he do with it? So Amasa went to summon Judah, but he delayed beyond the set time that had been appointed him. So he kind of blew it right off the bat. Had a huge opportunity to have proved his worth to David and taken this job seriously, understood the urgency of the moment in putting down this revolt, and for whatever reasons, didn't do it. So David is running out of generals. David said to Abishai, now Sheba the son of Bichri will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he get himself to fortified cities and escape from us. And there went out after him Joab's men and the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men. They went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba the son of Bichri. When they were at the great stone that is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Now Joab was wearing a soldier's garment, and over it was a belt with a sword in his sheath fastened on his thigh. And as he went forward, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, is it well with you, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand. So Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow, and he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba the son of Bichri, and one of Joab's young men took his stand by Amasa and said, whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab. And Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the highway, and anyone who stopped came by seeing him stopped. And when the men saw that all the people stopped, he carried Amasa out of the highway into the field and threw a garment over him. When he was taken out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba the son of Bichri. So Amasa did not last very long. He did not, apparently, take seriously the assignment that he was given, or at least not the urgency of it. That was his first mistake. But his second mistake was that he was heedless of the fact of who his enemy was. Now, Joab was his cousin, but he had to know the history. He had to know that Joab murdered Abner because he saw him as a rival, no doubt. That Joab had killed Absalom, specifically against David's orders. That Joab was the guy whose job he had just been given. And so he sees him in the road, and I don't know exactly what happened here, but it sounds as though Joab may have had two swords. He would have had one on the left, which is where you commonly wore your sword so that you could draw it with your right hand. And somehow that fell off, and so Amasa thought, okay, it's fine. And so he went in for this brotherly embrace and ended up getting stabbed with Joab's sword that was in his left hand. What can we learn from this example? First of all, you and I also have been given a job to do, and it is urgent. Jeff brought this up at the last encounter. Every minute, over 100 people go into eternity all around the world. Since we've been here this morning, what would that be? About 6,000 or something? 8,000? Souls are constantly going into eternity. And the chances are very good that you will at least see someone today that a year from now will have no more choices to make in this life. And we never know. I remember there was a young man that I used to work with. He was probably a little older than me. He and I had a conversation just randomly one day about how you get into heaven. It just came up because we were carrying a truck box and he remarked that it looked like a coffin. And so we started talking about death and we started talking about eternity. I was always so glad that I took 15 seconds to share the gospel with him. Because about a year after that, he was dead. Overdosed on drugs and died. And I highly doubt that he was trusting in Christ. But I would have felt so terrible if I had not taken the one opportunity that I had to at least have told him it's through Jesus. This is urgent. We cannot sit here on our hands and act like everything's going to be okay and people are somehow going to hear. No, they're not. They're not. Scripture says, how do they hear without a preacher? How will they preach unless they're sent? This is our job, what Jesus told us to do. And we have to recognize the urgency. And secondly, in case you haven't gotten the memo, we are in the middle of a war. If you are going to do this, if you're actually going to follow Christ and take his gospel to the world, you have put a target on your back and Satan is going to come after you. And he's going to be sneaky about it, much like Joab was. He's very likely not going to come at you with his teeth bared. He's probably going to come at you in some way like Joab came when he intended to kill Amasa. Hey, how you doing? Offer you something that sounds good, that sounds flattering, that sounds like something you have a right to. And you're like, there's no harm in this. There's no sword there. Yes, there is. I promise you there is. If it's coming from the enemy, if it's not coming from God, every good and perfect gift comes from God. If it's not coming from God, guess who it's coming from? It's coming from the enemy. And I promise you there's a sword in his hand. And he'll stick it in you if you give him half a chance. Peter knew this by experience. He knew what it was to get all confident and bluster and be like, I'll go to death with you, Jesus, and almost ended up getting stabbed to death himself, spiritually speaking. And this is the advice that he gave us in 1 Peter 5, verse 8. Be sober-minded. Be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. I found out the other day that tigers look green to prey animals like deer. Did you know that? They look orange to us, and we think, I mean, that looks pretty obvious. It's an orange and black striped animal, you know, prowling around the forest. Deer can't see them because they have different vision, dichromatic or something like that. And the tigers blend right into the trees. And that's how they manage to catch their prey. The devil doesn't make a racket when he comes and tries to take us off the path, when he comes and tries to destroy and to steal and to kill. He comes subtly, sneakily, in ways that you don't expect. If I told y'all that there was a mountain lion had been spotted right around this area and it already killed several people, what would you be thinking about as you walk to your car as we leave the building? What would be your attitude? I mean, I know myself, my head would be on a swivel. Like, I'd make sure I had my wife and my kids right there, and I'd be like, okay, let's run very quickly to the car, let's get in. And anything that looked even remotely like a mountain lion, I would be like ready to get away. Jason would just shoot it, but I don't have a shooting iron, so I'd probably miss even if I did. Probably kill me. But anyway, the point is, we wouldn't be just like, oh really, a lion, okay, well that's interesting. I think I'll lay down here and take a nap. Your enemy wants to destroy you. We are not in this world to kick back and have a good time. I'm not saying don't enjoy yourself with the goodness that God has given you. Peter's not telling us to live in fear, but he is telling us to be alert when we interact with the world, because this world is not our home. Because the prince of this world is not our friend. He is our vicious, committed enemy that is looking for any opportunity that we give him to destroy us. So watch for the sword in his hand. Verse 14. And Sheba passed on through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Bethmaachah, and all the Bichrites assembled and followed him in. And all the men who were with Joab came and besieged him in Abel of Bethmaachah. They cast up a mound against the city, and it stood against the rampart, and they were battering the wall to throw it down. Then a wise woman called from the city, "Listen, listen, tell Joab, come here that I may speak with you." And he came near her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" He answered, "I am." Then she said to him, "Listen to the words of your servant." And he answered, "I am listening." Then she said, "They used to say in former times, let them but ask counsel at Abel, and so they settled a matter. I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord?" Joab answered, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not true. But a man of the hill country of Ephraim called Sheba the son of Bichri has lifted up his hand against King David. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city. And the woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba the son of Bichri and threw it out to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they dispersed from the city, every man to his home. And Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king. This interaction is a very interesting mirror image of one that we saw in chapter 14. So you may recall, when Absalom was in exile, Joab perceived that David wanted to bring him back. And he helped to make that happen by enlisting the services of a wise woman from Tekoa. He instructed this woman, who was basically a paid actor, to come to David and create the scenario in which he would be emotionally influenced to issue an unconditional pardon to her supposed son, who had supposedly killed his brother in the heat of rage. So she got him to basically pardon a murderer who was, as far as the story she told, pretty much unrepentant. And then she was instructed to turn this logic to the matter of Absalom, who had, of course, murdered, in reality, his brother Amnon, leading David, naturally, to pardon Absalom as well. And Joab's plan worked to perfection, and also nearly destroyed the kingdom. Because David took an unrepentant rebel, Absalom, back into the palace, that rebellion spread, and it nearly cost him his throne, his life, the lives of his family, and his most loyal servants. Now, Joab finds himself confronted at this city of Abel by someone who is also called a wise woman, but in this case is truly wise. She has not been coached. And she also lives in a time in which women didn't generally speak up uninvited or take much of a hand in determining the course of events as a rule. But this woman, who's never named, takes it upon herself to parley with Joab, and she entreats him to spare her city, much as the woman that Joab hired entreated David to spare her son. And what she gets Joab to admit, you know, Joab, his solution, his and Abishai was just kill everybody. Like, that this is the answer, just kill him and that'll fix the problem. And so he was ready to, like, destroy the whole city. But she got him to admit that his quarrel wasn't with the city. It wasn't even with Sheba's followers. It was only with Sheba himself. He was the rebel who had lifted up his hand against the king. So armed with that information, she goes back to her people and says, look, this is how we fix this problem. We kill the rebel, we throw his head over the wall to Joab, and it's done. This is the exact opposite, you see, of the conclusion that Joab had gotten the Tekoite woman to convince David of. Joab managed to convince David, you can take a rebel back. It's okay. It'll be fine. The argument she was actually making was that the justice that God prescribed, which was a life for a life, was too extreme. That God himself would not require that extreme of a solution. That there was a better, an easier way. But the woman from Abel told her people the truth, which they may not have wanted to hear, which is that they had to man up and deal with the rebel, or there was going to be no peace, and they would be destroyed along with him. You see, wisdom is not about finding a workaround. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Why is the fear of the Lord the beginning of wisdom? Because God is the origin of all truth and reality. And if you do not have reverence for him, if you do not accept that his word is the truth and is the final say on everything in this life, then, as they say in the Russian proverb, you started the trepak on the wrong foot. You're going to be off wherever you go. You'll be on one of those paths that leads the wrong way. Because there's an infinite number of those that are wrong and only one that's right. And the one is the fear of the Lord. It is to say, God is right. We start with that. What did he say? Now let's see how we apply it step by step. But the wisdom of this world is all about circumventing. It's all about finding another way. Like, surely God couldn't require that. Surely God is not going to send anyone to hell. Surely God didn't require his own son to suffer on the cross and to give his life. Surely Christ doesn't require that we forsake all if we're going to be his disciples. That's too extreme. It's the truth. It doesn't matter how we feel about it. If it's true, it's true. As Ben Shapiro likes to say, facts don't care about your feelings. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And she had wisdom. She did not lie. She didn't say, hey, there's an easier way. There's some kind of negotiation we can do. She said, kill that man, and this is over with. And they did, and it was. We must never, ever lie, not to ourselves, not to anyone else, to say, there's some way that you can get into the kingdom of God other than coming through the narrow door, other than laying it all down. God never rescinded his decree that the soul that sins will die. That's Ezekiel 18, verse 4. And the wages of sin is death, Romans 3:23. God did not create a workaround, a technicality, a loophole to allow sinners into his kingdom. Instead, he did the unthinkable. It was the only way. Because he said the rebel has to die. And so that left us out in the cold. But then he said, I will take your place. And God's sinless son was executed in the rebel's place, outside the city, which is where rebels died. He took the wrath of the king as though he had rebelled. And that brought the rebellion to an end for anyone that would accept him. And I've said this before, this is why the sacraments of the church are so important, because of what they mean. Because when we are baptized, what we are basically saying is that we agree with this judgment. Cut off the rebel's head. There can only be one king. When you go under the water and you come up again, that's what you're saying. There can only be one king. This one's going to die. I'm going to be crucified with Christ, accepting the death sentence that has been passed on every rebel, and I will become part of his kingdom. When we take communion, baptism is one time, communion is over and over again. When we come to the Lord's table, we take the bread that represents his body. We take the cup that represents his blood. And we are saying, this is what I choose again. For him to be included in his sacrifice and his death and his resurrection. This is the way God ordained to make peace. There is no other way. And if we tell people that there is, we're lying to them, and we're setting them up for failure and for destruction. We must be uncompromising on this with ourselves, first of all, that the only way to life is death, that the only way to peace is the sacrifice of the cross, sacrifice of Christ on the cross that made peace between us and our one true King.